Good afternoon. You're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm William English, and today's guest is George Barber. Welcome, George. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Thank you very much for coming in. George Barber is, of course, a renowned video maker who came to prominence in 1985 with a scratch video, titles such as Absence of Satan. And even before that, George, I think you made something called Branson in 1983. Now, could you perhaps you could expand on that a little bit?
Well, it's a long story, but at the time, lots of people were cutting up. If you want to know the whole story, it was the dawn of sampling, so that the English had invented a machine called the Green Gate, which a friend of mine had. So I was sitting at home with a VHS recorder recording various... well, I was picking, if you like, trash television, except for Richard Attenborough shows. They're never trash. But I was looking for sounds. I knew I was going to make, if you like, mantras. And I wanted to take... odd sounds, phrases I liked, and repeat them. And also at the time, of course, I'd seen Dara Birnbaum, and she'd had a show at the ICA, I think in 83 or so, or 82 perhaps. So I knew it was possible to do this stuff on video, but at the same time, I realised when one tried it, it had a banal... If you just used video in an edit suite, it seemed a bit banal what you could do. So the idea was to take the sound and if you like Phil Spector, make a massive soundscape full of mantras and repetition and bits and pieces, all in tune and all nicely mixed, and then slip the pictures back. And I think that's where I progressed the tradition.
So Dara Birnbaum, she made a video called Wonder Woman, I think.
That's right.
What was that, 1978 or something?
Yeah, it would have been, I don't know, I can't recall. But
so would you have seen that at college, or was this after?
No, I saw it at the ICA.
Yeah, oh, right.
Yeah, and I would have been at the Slade by then.
Yeah.
So, but I was already playing with video, but I think...
Did you do painting or anything, or did you go straight into video? Were you always a video maker?
No, I wasn't always a video maker. No, it's quite curious the way one... I had been a sculptor, and I went... to St. Martin's in the late 70s, and yeah. I was one of the last people on the Conceptual A course,
right,
which had Richard Long and Gilbert and George. So it was an interesting course with lots of interesting staff. John Steseker was there, and Victor Bergen used to come in. And you have to remember, it was a different world compared to now. I think there were four teachers and seven students in my year. So, you know, maybe there were 20.
Intensive tutoring.
Yeah, right? So it was, well, that's another story. Yeah. But I was on a, most of the crowd were clever. You know, we were clever people, ambitious and kind of, listening to our tutors. Actually, we all became rather inhibited, I think. This was the late 70s. A lot of the art at that time was concerned with the social revolution. There was a sense in which there was a lot of union unrest. Britain was changing, the rise of feminism. There was a sense in which a lot of artists were walking around feeling guilty about things, say people were called Andreas. Andreas Whittam Smith changed his name to Andy Smith at this period.
Oh, right.
But what I'm trying to describe is a way in which I think some of my cutting up film and that using repetition and music was definitely kicking against this rather worthy art with captions. The mood of the times was basically one had to interrogate oneself and beat oneself up over one's class, one's gender, one's history, and somehow, if you like, all this stuff was embarrassing. And as artists, I think it kept people rather quiet and made them feel rather intimidated. And that was stultifying, But of course, by the mid-80s, it had all passed, and the word was desire, and pleasure.
Was there a point at which you sort of just said I'm not going to make sculpture anymore. I'm going to go just concentrate on videos.
Well, this was it. Partly because I'd left St. Martin's and was living in a squat, and you know, it's very difficult to store sculpture. I knew, I was kind of struggling a bit, but I realised I could do an MA. When I got to the Slade, just one day they happened to have an edit suite, a new U-matic Sony.
At the Slade?
Yeah, they brought one. And I just remember the guy getting it out of the box and thinking, yeah, this is it. This is what I'm going to do. Because, it clicked. I mean, it also clicked looking back because I was looking for something that was a bit more populist, I think. I wanted something. I liked the idea. Perhaps I'd had Warhol in my mind. But I liked the idea of taking the sort of rubbish television, B-movies, and actually putting a very certain British fine art sensibility over them so that anyone could see the nuts and bolts, like a collage. The nuts and bolts was trashy culture, cultural detritus, but the person was clearly an art person. This was clearly art.
And did you always use sort of repetition and appropriation, found footage? Was it from the word go?
Yeah. Well, you've got to remember as well, if you're kind of living in a squat, producing lush images, if your basic thing is trying to compete or address popular culture, you need to have a good look. You need the images to look attractive and in focus and lush. So there's not much. The kind of cameras I could get weren't going to do that. Right. So it was seemed to make sense to just use other people's footage.
Right. For the professionalism then? For instance, in Absence of Satan, you're using a Paul Newman film, aren't you?
Yeah, yeah.
Is it, and who's the woman in it? I can't remember.
Sally Field. Yeah.
And so the images have already come through Hollywood, so they've achieved a certain high degree of professionalism, which you presumably could not possibly have afforded yourself at the time.
Yeah, you're damn right. Yeah. Nor the stars. But the whole point is to make an intervention, isn't it? You know, to somehow take this Hollywood pompous material and twist it into something much more. As I said, you would just know it's definitely an art student at the helm here, because a lot of the kind of ways I put things together, you could say deconstruct, but it was more, I think one could be less pretentious than that, that one was reassembling the nuts and bolts in a more joyous, fun way.
Right. And, so what did you make after that? Absence of Satan and the... you were going to expand more about the Branson film. I think I might have interrupted you there. Could you describe that
briefly?
Well,
that became that. That was more... at that time, I'd noticed... I have a lot of respect for Richard Branson, but I'd noticed that even though he's a tremendously successful businessman, on all sort of media opportunities, hums and haws all the time. Uh-huh. And I sort of thought the idea of making a kind of music from speech impediments, if you like, or making music from someone's unfortunate characteristics. So I settled on him because, as I said, it seemed ironic to me that such a clever, successful businessman should be in a way socially presents himself so fumbling all the time.
Right.
But maybe that's how he wins his discussions and gets these good prices. I don't know.
So the idea of these ideas of repetition, which seem to have been a hallmark from the word go, does that relate at all to the music scene at the time?
I mean, that's what I was trying to say. I wouldn't claim, in any way I was there first, but it was going on. That kind of the dawn of the hip-hop sampling, and then there was that great record 19 Hard Castle. And then suddenly record companies were interested in what I was doing, and I managed to survive doing some videos and things. But most of the time, they just copied you. They wanted to meet you, and then they'd get someone much older to make it for them. That was always the same.
Is that right?
Oh, God, it's always the same in advertising, yeah.
Yes. So it's always the case that basically they would just take what they wanted.
They do it themselves, yeah. They're not going to let anyone new in. But a little bit of bitterness there. But but the stuff was definitely raided and copied.
Right.
But that's the price you pay if you sail closer to popular culture. Mm. I mean, that's all that will happen.
Were you never lured into that? world of, you know, where you might have made the money out of it as well?
As I said, it's very difficult. Yeah, they tend to just get an older person on the job.
Do they?
But I mean, this is a wider cultural formation, isn't it? The way you know, the mainstream renews itself. It's always. I mean, the funniest one was that I believe the French punks used to wear gold safety pins, sort of £300 a piece. So there's always ways and graffiti, you know, and Keith Haring and all these kind of things. Yes. It's funny, isn't it?
So you've been you're a writer as well, apparently. I'm not so familiar with your writing work.
Sure, we're going around the houses here, but when I left the Slade, I had to support myself. And you've got to remember the context was very different then. I mean, for example, if someone had said to you, there's a really great show in the middle of Hackney in an old warehouse where some young artists are putting on a show, I mean, no one would have been interested, because the way it was then was very much... the way the art world was structured, very much around the big names. I mean, of course, it still is, but there is a way in which around 88 with Hearst and Freeze, where that all changes, and suddenly it seems every collector wants to be in on the start of someone's career, so that you do get Royal College students selling their paintings at their annual show, which is a relatively new thing. So the context I had to face was much more... it seemed very kind of negative, and all the galleries I'd been around to seemed... I mean, they didn't even think, some of them, that it was art, the kind of things I was doing. And then there was all that sort of copyright stuff, and which seems to be less now. People don't seem to be so worried about that anymore. But to put you straight, I did some sort of work for The Independent, and I'd had a few things on Radio 4 and bits and bobs.
But the scratch video genre, as it were, it did make a sort of breakthrough, didn't it, into clubland and so on? I mean, it became...
But you've got to remember, I was, you know, at that time I was very ambitious, I suppose, and there were a group of us, and we didn't... I mean, I knew that video art, it probably still does, but I thought it sounded dull. The idea of changing the term, you know, to language is very effective like that, because it sort of rinses things of history. So I called it scratch video, as if it was some new thing. Yeah. And I think a lot of the press were fed the idea that it was like a load of guys down in Brixton sort of jacking up their VHS tapes together and making this stuff. But no, actually, most of the people were using broadcast equipment and the Duvet brothers, you know, they worked for...
Well, he worked in an editing suite.
So they had, and all my best work I did in fancy places.
Oh, really? It's a bit of a myth that it's a sort of lo-fi
I'll admit, we did tend to put that about, because it seemed to be with the story they wanted to hear. You know, they wanted this idea that was like from the ghetto, this kind of new video thing.
Yes.
Whereas in fact it was a load of middle class people.
Well, that sort of brings us nicely to this topic of anti-art and destruction, which we thought we might sort of somehow...
It's
get
a big
into.
Change, isn't it? Oh.
Is it?
All right.
Well, I don't know, actually. Yeah. I don't know that it is, because it's sort of... It sounds like you were trying to take on, an identity that was actually outside of the art world. You're trying to sound like you're coming from the ghetto, perhaps, to some extent.
Oh, well, in the mythology of it all.
Yes. Yes, but the mythology and the art history... become, they sort of intertwine, don't they?
Sure. Well, changing gear, I mean, my only, you know, you asked me about auto-destruction. I mean, there are a number of things. I mean, I think actually being creative is pretty destructive, in the sense that if you think, you know, across each year, across all photography courses, say in London, there's probably about 7,000 want-to-be photographers, and you could probably... similar number of painters. I mean, art, you know, for someone who wanted an easy life is pretty terrifying, because it is so... There are so many people doing the same thing. But, I mean, we're lucky in that...
Well, that's a strange thing, isn't it? That it's sort of as though people get involved in art probably because they think, to some extent, or it probably was the case a few decades ago, that they were opting out in some way, that they were not engaging with the real world.
But...
in fact, the way it is now, it's so competitive, it's probably one of the most competitive areas you can be involved in. As you say, you know, for every 7,000 students, there's going to be, what, three people that actually make it in.
Yeah, but then again, like, we can quickly get into another argument, which is, actually, does it matter? Because what people study is
it depends
them,
what effect it's having on those people. All those 6,993 that don't make it.
I think people should study photography if it's what their heart wants to do, because, you know, even if they end up not doing photography, it's still some legacy, something that was them.
Right.
You know, and I my hunch is most people sort of come back to some kind of image making, or they pull through somehow. But to get on to the auto-destruction, I mean, one of the things I was thinking about, which I'd noticed at various exhibitions, for example, the Tate Triennial, and Jill McGidd had something at Tate Modern, was, and Waleed Raid, who's got a show at Whitechapel at the moment. But my sort of thesis, or what I'd propose, is the idea that modernism is coming back with a story to it, or modernism is being represented to us with a bit of chat. So I'll start from the beginning. So if you like, modernism, most pieces were involved with abstraction, so that the modernist work was autonomous, so that it is what it is. You look at Bridget Riley's Stripes, and you're not supposed to think, oh, they look like New York, you know, the grid. No. It's just the work, just the colour. And so a Sol LeWitt box, again, it's just that shape in space. You're not supposed to think of construction or retail environments. But now you see, you know, you might go to an exhibition and you'll see a huge red dot on a white canvas. But no, someone will tell you, oh no, that's not a red dot. That's my, you know, my Palestinian mother died, bled to death in this painting.
Right.
So that we often, I mean, that's just an example, but the idea is we often, if you like, are presented with a classic piece of modernism, but now we get a whole chunk of story with it. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That, if you like, I mean, of course, it's a way of making art new again, but I think it's quite funny.
Do you remember Peter Halley and Neo Geo?
God, it rings a bell, but go on.
That was in the 80s.
Yeah.
And he was quite a bit of a theoretician, but he did these hard-edged geometric paintings. But in actual fact, it was a sort of an image of a fuse box or something.
Yeah, you know, sure.
A bit like the guy, the YBA, who does things that look like hospital doors, but it's just sort of like gloss paint.
Sure. Gary, isn't it?
Is it Gary Hume?
Yeah.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, but that's probably, you're thinking more of a narrative rather than
I mean, if you take Waleed Raid's thing, he, for example, in all the press I've seen so far, they talk about, I mean, he's got a very interesting childhood. You know, he's seen war and he's lived in the Lebanon over the last 20 years. And with various initiatives of his, like the Atlas Group and things, he's tried to, you know, collate and respond to it. But all the reviews of the art talk about his story and his life. And it's quite novel in art now. This, what I'm trying to sort of say, is the way modernism, if you like, the work of art's coming back, but it's always got a lot of story attached. Rather than, if you like, criticism or ideas, we seem to be often presented with art plus a rather nice kind of Dickens novel on the person's life. Do you sort of mean? And that seems to be a new trend, and often I think,
is this a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think it's a little bit of a sort of chat discourse, which seems, I think it is partly because it's easy stuff for the media to talk about, and so it tends to privilege people who've had extraordinary lives or odd lives or not mainstream lives. I mean, I don't mind it, and I think, you know, one has to, you know, in that sort of Burio sense, you know, art is constantly trying to renew itself, and that sort of full-blooded originality is difficult, but what we can do is try things anew. I mean, Waleed Raid's got some blue, various, I think, Secrets of the Open Sea, it's called, but it's some negatives he found, and after, they look totally destroyed, but upon close examination, they were actually people who drowned. But when they're printed up, they just look like field paintings. They are just solid blue.
Right.
You know, like
right.
If you look to the colour chart.
Mm.
But again, the principle of this art I'm describing is that what we're being given is a hard-edged piece of modernism, but actually you don't really get it unless you know that it's people being drowned and the story.
Right.
So all I would say is that whereas once, you know, modernism is being reinvented, if you like, or destroyed, because all I'm saying is you're often coming across the scene or coming into a gallery to see what seems to be a classic piece of modernism, but it turns out, you know, there's a whole load of gumph that you've got to kind of listen to, and that sometimes means you don't really even have to go because this story in itself is kind of so fascinating. The stuff around the art is more fascinating. And, you know, you take Simon Starling, you know, you go into Round Freeze and you see the most anodyne shots of a red, whacked-out Volvo estate, Big Prince. And, you know, and then you find out, oh, well, he transported plants across Spain and planted them at various spots in some kind of biodiversity art thing. But, I mean, the point is that it really looks like the most ordinary shot of a Volvo. I mean, could a Volvo be shot any other way? But the point is,
but are you saying would the image not stand up on its own?
No. This is the point.
Right.
That modernism, what you were saying, had to be in the piece. The piece was the piece, and that you were taught, you know, at St. Martin's, all these places, that you don't look for metaphor, you don't look for literary conceits, you don't your story, you know, your personal story isn't of no interest in the art really. I mean, of course, it's different in literary criticism and various other criticisms, but maybe I've got too high standards myself for art. But the idea.
You sound slightly suspicious of it.
Sure. I, on one hand, I think it's interesting because I have been looking. I mean, I liked Jill Magrid's story, is funny. She makes work with the Dutch Secret Service, who there's some law in Holland which requires institutions to make art.
I think I saw those at Tate Modern, and that's
they avoid her, and she's struggling to make the art because they're Secret Service. And of course, that's all interesting. But my point would be, what does she end up making, which is words in neon lights? Those neon lights would never tell you that story. It would have to be read out to you, or you'd have to read the boards. So that I mean, you asked me. So that's something I brought to the show about the demise and destruction of modernism. Will that do?
That's the destruction of modernism, not the destruction of art, but never mind.
Okay. Oh, God.
But never mind. But let's get back to you. You've been very generous talking about all these other artists.
Oh, okay, yeah.
You've got a show at the moment in Dundee.
Yeah.
Which is of videos?
Yes, it's a selection from my career. There's my big hit, which is automotive action painting, where I kind of throw paint on the road and then cars.
Yes, that's amazing. Yes, I've watched that on your website. This is an aerial shot, looking down onto a road.
Yeah,
is it you that's spreading pools of colour? Buckets of colour onto the road, and then traffic is forced. Well, they can't avoid it; they have to drive through it. Thereby turning the road into a sort of an abstract image, as it were. Is that right? Was that for real? I mean, were these cars, you didn't stage this, or...
We had to ask people before they came in, because if someone had a really fancy car...
Yeah, and they got paint on it.
Well, they might get upset. It worked fine, because it was all emulsion.
Was it? Okay.
And we had big high-pressure hoses, so...
And what about the shouting piece? What's this one?
Well, that is... God, you're going fast.
Well, we're running out. We're running out of time rapidly. This is the trouble with a 30-minute show. You have to kind of sort of, you know... Sorry. We'll slow down. We've got minutes left.
I was still on the car thing.
I'm sorry.
No. Well, okay. Well, the shouting match is...
We don't want to turn into a shouting match.
No. I don't think there's any fear of that. But the shouting match is a conceptual idea, and it came from the idea in our culture that if you watch TV or listen to the radio, that the people who, if you like, have no censorship between their mouth and their brain are kind of well regarded. I mean, you know, that ability to just talk. And similarly, the people who make a lot of noise, it is the case that people are on screen because of that ability to just keep on going and you know, The Gift of the Gab. But,
right.
But at the same time, make
which
a
I've
lot
never
of noise.
Had.
Okay, well, I'm
quite
notice.
Envious of people.
Anyway,
so what is the mechanics of this piece? You've got two people on like pulleys, haven't you? Don't they come
well,
towards each other? And
it's slightly, it's not scientific, but what happens is the helpers, the people who push the people at shouting at each other, they judge between themselves who's making the most noise. And the more noise you make, the more centre of the screen you are, and the quieter you are, the more you're withdrawn.
Hmm.
So basically, if you don't make a noise, you're history. You're out the frame. And so this is the game. This is set up. And, you know, like a lot of early video art, it works because it's quite painful for people and they struggle. And to some extent, I think interesting... well, it's a long story. We haven't got time. But it, to some extent, I think some of the older ways of making video art, if we go right back to the earliest traditions, Acconci, Abramovich, Bruce Nauman, and say Peter Campers, some of these... You know, they are classics, and they're not beaten. And a lot of people have... like Bruce Nauman regularly shows up in people's work.
Yeah.
But the idea of doing simple actions and using the body as the material works very well. So when people shout, it is an index of their personality. And there's something both funny about it initially, but then quite depressing. Because, yes, it gets you down, people shouting. I mean, if you're on a train and two people are arguing... It's hard to think, isn't it? It's hard to read a book.
Yeah, yeah.
They kind of take over one's, colonise one's space. But
well, as I was saying earlier as well, there is this tendency on the part of some people to sort of browbeat by their voices raise until it becomes like a weapon almost, the shouting down of the person they're talking to.
Well, I think that's nerves, isn't it? It's not something
Could
we're going to be doing, is it?
We are now rapidly running out of time, and I'm going to finish up with a track.
Okay.
So thank you very much, George Barber. And when does this show finish at Dundee?
It's got a night. It's a whole month.
A whole month.
From the 23rd.
And what's it called? It has a title? Or?
The Long Commute.
The Long Commute. Okay. And anything coming up in London soon? Shortly?
I've got... there's nothing definite, but I've Waterside Projects.
Oh, right. Okay.
Well, I think it has gone to sleep. Yes.
Sorry, I was going to play a CD, but it's gone to sleep. We'll play the ticking clock again.
The Milky Way, she walks around, both feet firmly off the ground. Two worlds collide, here comes the future bride. Give me a lift to the lunar base, I want to marry a monster from outer space. I fell in love with an alien being whose skin was jelly, whose teeth were green, big bug eyes, death ray glare, feet like water wings, purple hair. I was over the moon, I asked her back to my place, and then I married the monster from outer space. We walked out, tentacle in hand, you could sense that the earthlings would not understand. They go and we got on the